bullshit. Like, it's disgusting. Like, it really f-ing is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Like, dude, you.
So, personal attacks, ad hominems, lies, distortions, weaponization of insults. You've really said it all, sir. You've really said it all. We have a really good bonus show for you today. We are going to talk about Jared Kushner's Middle East actions, now under scrutiny after the terrorist attack in Israel. The White House and lawmakers are weighing linking funding for Ukraine and aid to Israel. Many people are not pleased with that. And California Governor Gavin Newsom has vetoed a bill allowing Amsterdam-style cannabis cafes in California. He's also vetoed a bill allowing decriminalization of psychedelics. We will talk about all of it. You can like Newsom and disagree with some of his decisions, by the way. That's allowed. That's perfectly reasonable. All of those stories and more when producer Pat joins me on today's bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Let's make some money on the bonus show. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code 4 years 4 indictments to get a sizable discount off of the cost of a membership. It's really cheap either way. And we try to really stuff membership with a bunch of perks. So I will see you then. And otherwise,
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
We start today with truly horrifying headlines from Israel and from the Gaza Strip. I did get actually disproportionately positive reaction yet.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is where people in Gaza used to flee from the northern and eastern part, seeking safety. This is Gaza City, the center of Gaza City, where people used to consider it safety. This is just to prove that there is no place safe in Gaza.
Hospitals are going to be turned into graveyards. That's the warning from the International Red Cross about the dire situation in Gaza, where Israel's massive bombardment has killed over 1,350 people, including 326 children. Much of Gaza is without electricity, and supplies of food and water are dwindling amidst Israel's devastating siege imposed after Hamas's surprise attack on Saturday that killed over 1,300 people in Israel. We'll go to Gaza for the latest.
Come and see how the Palestinians are struggling in Gaza now. We no longer have the basic needs for life here. Life has ended in Gaza. The Palestinian residents in Gaza are in UNRWA shelters, but they have no water, no electricity, no bread even.
We'll also go to Tel Aviv to speak with a leading Israeli human rights attorney. He writes, Israelis must maintain their humanity even when their blood boils. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gaza's humanitarian crisis is deepening as Israel continues to pummel the besieged Palestinian territory with air and artillery attacks for a sixth straight day, reducing whole neighborhoods to rubble. Gaza's Ministry of Health says Israel's attacks have killed more than 1,350 Palestinians and wounded more than 6,000. More than 320 children are among the dead. Survivors have been seen searching the rubble of their homes for lost possessions and food.
We left our homes thinking we would return in an hour. We left our belongings, money, food, and everything we owned. Now there are 50 people left homeless without food, drink, water, or electricity. I do not know how we will provide food for our children. I am searching here under the rubble for even the remains of lentils and rice, even a little for my children.
Israel's energy minister said no basic resources or humanitarian aid, including water, will be allowed into Gaza until Hamas releases hostages. His warning came after Gaza's only power station ran out of fuel, plunging the territory into darkness. The International Committee of the Red Cross warned in a statement, quote, as Gaza loses power, hospitals lose power, putting newborns in incubators and elderly patients on oxygen at risk. Kidney dialysis stops and X-ray can't be taken. Without electricity, hospitals risk turning into morgues, they said. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, reports at least 340,000 Palestinians have been displaced across the Gaza Strip. UNRWA also reports Israeli strikes have killed 9 UN staffers since Saturday, with bombs damaging 18 schools being used as makeshift shelters. UNRWA's headquarters in Gaza City was also damaged by an Israeli strike. In Israel, the death toll from Hamas's surprise assault has climbed to 1,300, with 3,300 Israelis injured. An estimated 150 Israelis are being held by Hamas as hostage. Israel's former defense minister, the opposition party leader, and retired General Benny Gantz said he would join an emergency wartime government and war cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and current defense minister Yoav Gallant. On Wednesday, Netanyahu said every Hamas member was a dead man, while Gallant said he would wipe Hamas off the face of the earth. The remarks came amidst widespread reports Israeli troops are massing for a ground invasion of Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers killed at least 2 Palestinians today in an attack on a funeral procession for 4 Palestinians killed one day earlier by mass settlers and Israeli soldiers. Israeli troops have placed the entire West Bank on lockdown and have killed at least 27 Palestinians since Saturday. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said his ministry purchased 10,000 assault rifles plus helmets and body armor to arm settlers. Ben-Gvir was previously convicted of racist incitement against Palestinians and supporting a terrorist organization. Israel's army has blamed human error for a false alarm Wednesday that triggered air raid sirens in northern Israel and sent residents scrambling for bomb shelters. Israel's army initially reported a suspected infiltration from Lebanon into Israeli airspace. The alert came as armed groups continued to trade fire with Israel's army across Lebanon's border. Meanwhile, in breaking news, Syrian state television reports an Israeli attack has disabled the main airports in the capital Damascus and the city of Aleppo in northern Syria. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Tel Aviv for emergency talks with Israeli officials. Blinken was greeted by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who thanked the U.S. for its support against the, quote, barbarians of Hamas. Blinken said 25 U.S. citizens are among those killed by Hamas. The U.S. has vowed to keep supporting Israel with aid and military equipment and warned Iran to be careful. Some reports have linked Iran to Hamas's attacks in Israel. Meanwhile, some Republicans are calling for an all-out annihilation of Gaza. This is South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
We're in a religious war here. I am with Israel. Do whatever the hell you have to do to defend yourself. Level the place.
The group Jewish Voice for Peace has called for the U.S. to restrain Israel, writing, quote, the U.S. must work to immediately de-escalate to prevent the further loss of life and not fuel and exacerbate the violence by sending more weapons to Israel. There's only one way to end violence, to address its root cause, 75 years of Israeli military occupation and apartheid. We must end U.S. complicity in this systemic oppression, said the group Jewish Voice for Peace. In Ankara, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan condemned Israel's blockade of Gaza and its relentless bombing campaign as a massacre.
Cutting off a city's water, electricity, entry and exits, collapsing its infrastructure, destroying all of its centers of worship from mosques to churches, as well as their schools, preventing people from getting the most fundamental needs, and bombing housing units where civilians reside. In other words, managing a conflict using every sort of embarrassing method. This is not a war. It is a massacre.
On Wednesday, the Arab League convened an emergency meeting in Cairo where it called on Israel to immediately halt its attacks on Gaza for a return to negotiations with Palestinians. In Brussels, Belgium, leaders of the European Commission and European Parliament led a moment of silence Wednesday for victims of Hamas. The EU leaders did not mention Palestinian civilians killed by Israel. Landmarks across Europe were lit up in blue and white colors of the Israeli flag. The Eiffel Tower in Paris, the Bulgarian Parliament, and the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, where on Wednesday several hundred protesters defied a ban on pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Several protesters were arrested. Elsewhere, hundreds in Vienna, Austria, defied a ban on protest to call for an end to Israel's assault on Gaza. The World Food Program's appealing for the international community to do more to help Afghanistan after it suffered two major earthquakes in recent days, exacerbating an already dire humanitarian crisis.
This is a disaster on top of a disaster on top of a disaster on top of a disaster. Currently, we have 15 million people who do not know where their next meal will come from. And the World Food Program is only able to support 3 million people due to a massive funding shortfall. So we're really calling on the international community to support the Afghan people, stand in solidarity, and also support the World Food Program.
International funding has steadily dropped after the Taliban takeover 2 years ago. The U.S. has frozen billions of dollars in Afghan assets in New York. The U.N. and other groups have also been restricted by the Taliban's ban on women aid workers. Here in the United States, House Republicans have nominated Majority Leader Steve Scalise to be the next Speaker of the House following Kevin McCarthy's ouster last week. But Scalise doesn't appear to have enough support to win the 217 floor votes needed to secure the position. A number of Republicans have said they will vote for Ohio Congressmember Jim Jordan, who is also vying for the leadership position, or for Kevin McCarthy again. During his time as a state lawmaker in Louisiana, Scalise spoke as a guest at a white supremacist group. He once told a reporter he was like David Duke without the baggage, a reference to the Louisiana politician and Ku Klux Klan leader. The House will not be able to resume legislative business until a new speaker is elected, including work on a bill to keep the government funded beyond November 17th. In labor news, United Auto Workers in Kentucky shut down Ford's largest plant as the union escalates its stand-up strike against the big three automakers, which includes GM and Stellantis, as well as Ford. The plant employs nearly 9,000 union workers who make some of the company's most profitable vehicles, including pickup trucks and SUVs. Meanwhile, in Canada, auto workers for General Motors ended their strike less than a day after it started, after reaching a tentative deal over pay and pensions. And acclaimed Indian author and activist Arundhati Roy could be prosecuted in India over a speech she made in 2010 about the disputed and militarily occupied Kashmir region. A criminal complaint was first filed against Roy that year, accusing her of advocating for the secession of Kashmir from India. The territories partially governed by India and Pakistan, both countries claim Kashmir in full. After 13 years, a top New Delhi official has reportedly approved the case to proceed. Arundhati Roy's two other co-defendants have since died. Many around the world have come to Roy's defense, condemning her targeting as an attempt to silence Roy and others who are critical of the far-right Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Roy recently attended a protest in New Delhi in response to the coordinated police raids on the homes and offices of dozens of prominent Indian journalists. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The International Red Cross has issued a dire warning about the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, saying, quote, hospitals are going to be turned into graveyards. Israel is continuing its devastating bombing campaign while blocking all food, water, and fuel from entering the besieged territory. An Israeli ground invasion appears imminent. Gaza's only power plant has stopped operating due to a lack of fuel. According to the United Nations, all of Gaza's 13 hospitals are only partially operational due to a lack of fuel and medical supplies. Gaza's Ministry of Health says at least 1,350 Palestinians have been killed since Israel began bombarding the territory after Saturday's surprise attack by Hamas. Meanwhile, the death toll in Israel has topped 1,300, including at least 200 Israeli soldiers. According to authorities in Gaza, Israeli attacks have killed at least 326 Palestinian children. The dead also include at least 7 Palestinian journalists, 11 staffers at the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, and 4 medics. Earlier today, an Israeli strike killed 18 Palestinians in the Nuseirat refugee camp. Many children are now seeking refuge in the courtyard at Al-Shifa Hospital, which is considered to be one of the only safe places in Gaza. Ramas Abu Tabikh is an 11-year-old Palestinian girl.
I have spent my 11 years in fear and anxiety. We left our home and stayed in the streets. There are planes. It's all scary. They are bombing us. Even while we're here, they are bombing us and we're scared.
As a 15-year-old child, I'm displaced from my home and came here to Al-Shifa Hospital. We're sleeping in the hospital with nonstop bombing above us. I hope that the world will have mercy on us.
That was Mohammed Halas, a 15-year-old Palestinian boy, speaking in the courtyard of the Al-Shifa Hospital. Other Palestinians seeking refuge at the hospital called for the international community to help stop Israel's bombardment.
They slaughtered our children and destroyed our houses over our heads. And here we are in the streets and hospitals. They've demolished all the houses on us and on the children and toddlers and women. And here we are scattered. Let the world come and see how it is packed here. Dead bodies are stacked over each other. Children and toddlers. No country is able to control Israel. Where is the United States? Where is the rest of the world? Let them say something. You don't see how affected we are. We're homeless. We're destroyed. It's been 5 days with no food and water, and we don't know where to go. Children are everywhere, here and homeless. This is not right. Let the world support us. We are restless. We are poor people, the Palestinian people.
Israeli authorities are vowing to continue the siege of Gaza until Hamas releases the 150 or so hostages it seized during Hamas's unprecedented attack on Saturday. This is Yifat Zeller, an Israeli woman who fears six of her relatives, including a nine-month-old baby, were taken hostage.
It all started Saturday morning, 5 days ago. Around 9 o'clock in the morning, we lost connection with my family that lives down south in Kibbutz Nir Oz. When the military finally entered the kibbutz and went through the houses to look for survivors, they didn't find my aunt and uncle in their apartment, and they are considered missing as well. So this is the situation. Six members of my family right now are being held in Gaza. Time is rushing. There's a 9 months baby and a 3-year-old child, and my aunt has Parkinson's disease. I want them back. We all want our family back.
We go now to Gaza, where we're joined by two guests. Mosaba Boutaha is a Palestinian poet and author, columnist, teacher, founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza. His recent piece for The Washington Post is headlined, "In Gaza, No One Can Believe Their Eyes." He's the author of the award-winning book, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. And we're joined by Yusuf Hamash, an advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He lives in the Gaza Strip with his wife and two kids. He recently posted his video showing the destruction of Gaza.
This is where people in Gaza used to flee from the northern and eastern part, seeking safety. This is Gaza City, the center of Gaza City, where people used to consider it safety. This is just to prove that there is no place safe in Gaza. You see? Destruction is everywhere. Where the people can go, where we should go.
That was Yusuf Hamash, advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Yusuf, let's begin with you. Describe the situation. What does a total siege of Gaza mean right now? From the hospitals to the schoolyards where people are taking refuge, describe it for us.
So the siege in general is not new for Palestinians who live in Gaza. We are under the siege for more than 17 years. Then add to that the cycles of violence, the non-ending cycles of violence. Especially this war, you cannot compare it with whatever we witnessed before. The massive bombardment that we see, destruction everywhere. If you want to cross from a place to another place, it's like a maze now. We couldn't recognize the areas where we move from a place to another place. Thousands of people get killed. Almost one-third population had fled their houses, seeking shelter at Onorogun, which is now over. And they're overwhelmed. It's all above their capacities. Now people who are lucky to have some relatives living in some areas considered safe. I'm really sorry. I don't think there is a safe place in Gaza, but sometimes people go in from a place when it's getting bombardment, especially from the north and eastern part of Gaza, seeking more safety in the center of Gaza City. The situation is unacceptable. You cannot imagine, again, what we ever seen in Gaza and in the streets and the daily life of people under this war, we never imagined it before. This is something, a new level of devastating war in Gaza.
And Yusuf, could you describe, given that devastation and the number of people who've been injured and displaced, what is the condition of the medical facilities in Gaza? The health ministry has warned that the healthcare system has truly begun to collapse.
So the medical sector in general already had an issue because it hadn't been upgraded since more than 17 years because of the siege and the blockade on Gaza. Now, without the lack of electricity and the number of people who get injured, thousands of people injured, they are above the capacity of the hospitals. I was in Shifa Hospital, and I saw how they were trying to provide medical treatment for injured people in the corridors, in the hospital, in the guard in front of the hospital, while it hosts also people are seeking shelter inside Shifa Hospital. Now, with lacking electricity, this is affecting everything. This is the entire process of the medical system is affected, while it's already collapsing before. It's a horrible situation. This is really horror. What we are seeing in Gaza now is really horror.
And what have you heard from Hamas about releasing the hostages or taking any steps to change the situation?
Unfortunately, until now, we didn't see anything in the horizon, either from the local or the de facto, or even from outside the world. We don't see a real intervention from outside or inside. No one is, you know, as a Gazan, I'm a Gazan, I'm a refugee from Jabalia camp. I don't have enough space in my head to think about the political situation and what they are doing now, or what we are thinking, trying to provide safety and shelter for our old children. We cannot provide our daily need without water, without electricity, no internet connection. To do this interview, I had to come from the northern part of Gaza where I live, where I'm hosted now because I had to flee my house, to Gaza City in a church to find internet just to have a space to deliver the message from Gaza. There is nothing in the horizon, either from inside or the outside, for a solution. And that's what makes us terrified. We cannot stay in this situation longer. With lack of everything in Gaza, within days, we will have nothing in Gaza. Now we have no electricity, no water, no food. But now, then we will lack food and others.
Yusuf Hamash, you have described the sound, the panic everywhere. Also, you are with the Norwegian Refugee Council, and you mentioned you came from the Jabalia refugee camp, which was bombed. If you can describe, where was it bombed? How many casualties? And also, you're with NRC. You have 52 staff members who live and work in Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says a total of 12 of its workers have been killed. How can you all function?
So first of all, to come from Jabalia to Gaza City to do this interview, it was literally a maze. Wherever in a street you go in, you will find destruction, rubble is everywhere. You will find people are trying to remove the rubble from here and there. It's a chaotic situation. Regarding our work as a humanitarian, even our staff, and I believe other partners in Gaza, we cannot secure ourselves to start to interfere. And our role as a humanitarian organization, the Norwegian Refugee Council, is to serve people who are forced displaced. Now we are trying to secure ourselves, which is rare. More, I don't have an accurate number, but I think the majority of our staff had to flee their houses, along with most of our partners here in Gaza, all the UN agencies. We cannot secure ourselves to interfere. This is one of the immediate things that we need, an access for us as humanitarian to deliver assistance for people who are already in dire need. More than before this war, more than half of the population was relying on humanitarian aid. We have one of the highest rates of employment rates on the planet. Add to that this circle of violence, people who were displaced with nothing. We need to serve these people. We are trying to evaluate how to interfere remotely with our partners, but until now, we cannot secure ourselves to start to deliver assistance for the others.
I'd like to bring in Mossab Abu Taha, who is also in Gaza, a Palestinian poet and author. He's a columnist, teacher, and founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza. His recent piece for The Washington Post is headlined, "In Gaza, No One Can Believe Their Eyes." He's also the author of the award-winning book titled "Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear: Poems from Gaza." Mossab, welcome to Democracy Now! If you could describe the situation around you and speak specifically about the impact of what's happening on children. You yourself have a 7-year-old daughter.
Well, in fact, I have 3 kids. The youngest is 3.5 years old. The situation hasn't changed. It started, as everyone knows, 6 days ago. The bombing never stopped. What is different this time is that every hour you hear about the deaths of dozens of people. Just last night in a refugee camp, a shelter refugee camp, about 15 people were pulled from under the rubble of their houses while they were sleeping inside, thinking that they were safe. I was born in that refugee camp, and now I live in Beit Lahia City, which is a city in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and the bombing hasn't stopped. I can see from my window plumes of smoke rising up in the sky, just covering every house that it crosses. And the children, of course, are victims. I mean, everyone in Gaza is a victim of what's happening and what has been happening in Palestine and in Gaza for so many years. But the children, especially, have been the main victims of these terroristic attacks, whether it's the sound of the explosions, the lights of the explosions, the shaking of the houses, the scenes on Facebook of so many limbless and beheaded people who were pulled from under the rubble of their houses. Just today, I mean, last night, my son, who is 3 years old, was sleeping, and there was that bombing in the area. And he woke up, and he said, "Who did that?" And he said, "Let it stop." I mean, that was the first time he was asking me to do that, as if I was responsible for the bombing. So I have nothing to do as a father. I have nothing to do as a neighbor or as a son. We are helpless here. We have been helpless all our lives, while the United States, unfortunately, is always stepping in to support Israel. And instead of trying to understand why what is happening is happening, and to change it and offer solutions, they are just adding more fuel to the fire.
How do you respond to President Biden? Anthony Blinken just arrived in Tel Aviv and had a news made a statement with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who say that terrorism will not be accepted. You have people like the far-right minister Bezalel Smotrich, who said Palestinians have one of three options, only either to immigrate or accept a life of subjugation to Israelis or die. Can you respond to what has taken place and these statements?
Well, this is not very shocking to me. In fact, if Mr. Blinken could visit Tel Aviv and stay with the Israelis there, I'm so sorry to say that the Palestinian president cannot come to Gaza and visit us because Israel would deny him permit. So there is a big difference between the supporters of Israel, the powers that are supporting Israel, and whoever wants to support the Palestinians, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank. I mean, why don't they come here and listen to us? I've never heard of any president coming to Gaza and talk to us as people the way that they come to Israel. And they are not only talking to them, they are providing them with assets. They are providing them with weapons. And they are trying these weapons on us. And we have no option. I mean, where do we immigrate? We were born on this land. My parents were born on this land. My grandparents were born on this land. My great grandparents were born here. But if you ask anyone in Israel, most of them would tell you that their grandparents were born somewhere else. And even I only have a Palestinian passport, which is really not very helpful when I leave Gaza. If I could leave Gaza. I mean, I remember one time when I went to the United States for the first time in 2019, I gave my passport to the officer at the airport, and they said, "Oh, your passport is expired." And they were reading the wrong date, because in Arabic, the dates are written from right to left, opposed to the English way of writing the dates from left to right. I panicked, in fact. He couldn't read that this is a Palestinian passport. This is from an Arab country. It's different from Europe and the United States. So where do we go? And Netanyahu, on the second day of the escalation, said, "Ask the Palestinians in Gaza to leave." He said, "Leave now." But where do we leave? And why should we leave? We have nowhere else to go.
Saab, earlier today, a Palestinian official said that Secretary of State Blinken will meet with a Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on Friday, that is to say tomorrow. Could you respond to that and what you think might come out of that meeting?
Well, unfortunately, President Mahmoud Abbas couldn't help with the situation in Gaza. I mean, if you want to help the Palestinians, you should come to Gaza. I mean, not necessarily these days. You could come, send any officials to the Gaza Strip and listen to our desires, listen to our basic needs. I don't want you just to say, "I'm going to meet President Mahmoud Abbas," with all due respect. He is the president of the Palestinian Authority. I think they are just meeting him because they want to show the world that we are meeting with Netanyahu and we are meeting with the Palestinian president. But this is not about it. This is not going to save our lives. Meeting with Netanyahu, I know they are supporting him economically, politically, militarily. But if he is going to meet with President Mahmoud Abbas, what is he going to tell him? Is he going to support him, send food trucks, medicine trucks to the Gaza Strip? Israel did threaten the Egyptians that if they are going to send any trucks into the Gaza Strip, they were going to bomb the trucks. And they did bomb the Rafah border crossing area, which led to Egypt shutting down the border crossing. And I did say in one time that Gaza has been the largest open-air prison in the world. Now it has become, with the closure of the two border crossing between Gaza and Rafah, Egypt, sorry, and Gaza and Israel, now it has become a prison cell with no window.
Yusuf, we have less than a minute to go. If you can talk about what needs to happen right now. The government media office has just released a statement warning the delay in response to the relief appeal is turning the besieged enclave into a mass grave.
To be done immediately, we need to stop all of these massacres happening around us, and we need a longer-term solution. We cannot keep finding ourselves in this circle of violence. If I can keep calculate for an hour that what I witnessed from the escalation, 2012, 2008, 2014, 2021, and I can keep calculating even the small escalation between them, we need a longer-term solution. The international community and the world leaders should stand ahead their responsibilities, ensuring a longer-term solution for Palestinians who live in Gaza. It starts by immediate stop for this war, and then lifting the blockade and finding a longer-term solution for us. This is unacceptable. We cannot keep finding ourselves. They made us feel useless in front of our children. I agree with my neighbors, but it's what we are going through is traumatizing us, and I really believe we need years to recover from what's going on now. This has to stop immediately.
Yusuf Hamash is advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Masab Abu Toha is a Palestinian poet and author. We'll link to his new piece in The Washington Post, In Gaza, No One Can Believe Their Eyes. Coming up, we go to Tel Aviv to speak to a leading Israeli human rights attorney. Back in 30 seconds. Lullaby by Sabrine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
To talk more about the Israeli assault on Gaza, the siege and Hamas's shocking attack on Israel, we're joined by longtime Israeli human rights lawyer Michael Sfard. He's an expert on international human rights and international laws of war. He represents Palestinian and Israeli activists and human rights organizations. He's also the author of the book, The Wall and the Gate, Israel, Palestine, and the Legal Battle for Human Rights. His new op-ed on Haaretz is titled, Israelis Must Maintain Their Humanity Even When Their Blood Boils. Michael Sfard joins us in Tel Aviv, Israel. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael, and welcome to Democracy Now! If you could talk about your piece that you wrote for Haaretz, Israelis Must Maintain Their Humanity Even When Their Blood Boils.
Well, good morning to you, and thank you very much for having me. These are terrible, terrible days. Actually, quite a nightmare that we're living through, and my heart goes out to the previous interviewees from Gaza. We have experienced a shock. I have to mediate to you the sentiment in the Israeli public, in the Israeli society. The attack on Saturday was a savage attack. Targeting civilians, going from one house to another in civilian neighborhoods and killing, murdering women, children, and elderly and innocent people, and also in the scene of the party, killing hundreds of people. And the blood boils. And the blood boils. It's not just that the blood boils, but also one feels a puncture in the heart, a hole in the stomach. And now the question is, what do you do with that? With this, confronting this inhuman attack? Do you fill the punctured heart and the hole in your belly with cement, with concrete? Or do you fill it with the warmth of compassion? And I'm afraid to say that many Israelis are extremely filled with rage and desire for revenge. And I, as a human rights lawyer, and in the last three decades, I have been working tirelessly, dedicating my professional career to protect the rights of everyone, and especially Palestinian communities who are under occupation, under a regime of apartheid, and under the very cruel blockade in Gaza. The only way that I know is to put a cry to adhere to the norms of international law. And I have to say, I want to shout, but I understand that at this time there is very little space for a voice like that. And when I hear the leaders of the State of Israel and the generals, and their rhetoric suggests that things that in the past they denied that the Israeli army is doing in the cycle of attacks on Gaza is now almost probably an official policy, targeting en masse inhabited areas, starving people as a method of warfare. I mean, if what Hamas has done was a blatant war crime, and I mean, the legal term is war crime, but in fact, it's a crime against humanity, not in the legal sense, but in the moral sense. It was an attack on everything that is human. To take hostage women with their children, elderly men and women on wheelchairs, this is just incomprehensible. But now my government is waging an attack that seems to be using war crimes to retaliate on war crimes, and this is definitely not what should be done now.
As a lawyer, as an Israeli, as a Jewish human rights lawyer, can you talk about what collective punishment means legally and morally? I mean, I think about the Pittsburgh synagogue, which was the worst killing of Jews in the United States in many years, this brutal attack this weekend, the worst killing of Jews since the Holocaust. But the idea of the response being to attack an area of land that is the home to over 2 million people, in this case, 2 million Palestinians. If you can explain, when the shooter shot up the Pittsburgh synagogue, they didn't destroy U.S. authorities, his community, his neighborhood. They went after him. They tried him. Michael Sefard, can you respond?
Yes. I mean, every moral, human moral system that I know rejects collective punishment, more definitely modern ones, but also we find it in the Bible that children should not bear the spoiled fruits that their fathers have eaten. I mean, there are many, many commandments, even in the Bible, which is a very old system of norms. That says that people should individually be found responsible for crimes that they are committing. And of course, international law, modern international law, prohibits, with no exception, collective punishment. We have very clear language written into the Fourth Hague Regulations of 1907 and in the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. But I don't think I need to reference to to international treaties. It is something that each and every one of us has to have as an instinct, as a moral basic principle. People should bear responsibility for their deeds, and not their neighbors, and not their people, and not their sisters or brothers or mothers or fathers. And it's not the first time that Gazans are paying the price for things that are done by Hamas or by other groups in the Palestinian society, and not only in Gaza but also in the West Bank. I mean, this is abhorrent, but this is exactly what's going on. And under international law, it's a war crime to inflict collective punishment, definitely on civilians.
Michael, I mean, more Israeli citizens were killed Saturday than during the entire Second Intifada of 2000 to 2005. As Amy mentioned, more Jewish people were killed than 1,300, over 1,300 since the Holocaust. Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, speaking earlier today, invoked the experience of his stepfather, who survived the concentration camps of Auschwitz and Dachau. Now, if you could say, you've said, it's very important to understand the context under which Hamas's attack took place. Do you believe in Israel or elsewhere there are enough people coming out with your position condemning both Hamas's attack as well as the occupation and Israel's response in Gaza?
There are people in Israel that have the same sentiment that I've voiced in my op-ed and I'm expressing here. But I have to be honest. I mean, we're experiencing now a huge setback. I don't know when there will be space for these kind of messaging in Israel or in Palestine, for that matter. When the blood boils, people choose and this is probably a human feature, but it's not a good one. Humans have many, many good features, but they have a lot of bad ones, and this is a bad one. They want revenge, as if a revenge would bring back those, the dear ones that are gone. And yes, in reference to the Holocaust, people in Israel have a very special mental vocabulary, and the events of Saturday have immediately triggered the scenes of pogroms in Russia and Ukraine of the 19th century, and of course the Holocaust, and the threat of annihilation, which is of course irrational because we have an army that had a huge collapse, and of course one that would be investigated, and an amazing failure, and yet the Israeli army is strong, and Israel is not under a threat of annihilation, and yet this is exactly what people feel, and one have to understand that in order to understand the Israeli sentiment. People are feeling under threat of annihilation, and that is a part of our collective psychology. It's not just benign. It's not just something that we've grown into by chance. It's something that is injected and indoctrinized from early age. I'm not different in that sense. I mean, I have to struggle with making these comparisons, and that allows the Israeli government and the Israeli army to do stuff that are just that people should, in a normal circumstance, object to.
How do you respond, Michael Sefard, when you bring up the occupation, not as a justification for what happened this weekend, but saying that it is essential to understand and to resolve at this point that these are not two equal nations where one invaded another? In the midst of all of this, Israel is responsible for what happens in the West Bank and Gaza.
Yes, Amy, context is important, but I want to pause for a moment and say context is important in order to understand the root causes and in order to think of what is the way out, what is the way forward. But sometimes context is brought as a means to mitigate the horrific nature of what has happened. So while I am ready and I will say some things about context, I do wish to say that what we've seen on Saturday has no justification whatsoever. It's a crime, it's inhuman, and this is something that, because every abhorrent crime in humanity's history has a context, of course. So having said that, yes, Gaza is under occupation, and it's not just any occupation. It's an occupation coupled with a cruel blockade that put more than 2.5 million people for more than a decade and a half in a closed-up area where Israel controls most borders and the airspace and the goods that flow in and the people that go in and out, and Israel retains Gaza on the verge of suffocation. And this is inhuman. And by the way, in the line of those responsible for this blockade, Israel stands first. But the line is long, and it includes the Western world that allows it. I can't recall any other context in which the international community and the Western powers allowed such a blockade on millions of innocent people and not came over with a plan to end it. So occupation, and yes, Israel is the strong power here, and yes, Israel is the one that maintains that blockade. And if you look in the last decade and a half, it seemed like there was no reason for Israel to change its policy. America was fine with it. Europe was fine with it. The UN didn't do much about it. And I just hope, I hope from this very deep pit that we're in, that we will start now to, I mean, we're now in the eye of the storm. So it is too early to say where we're heading. But I, you know, I don't pray. I'm not a religious person. But I desire that maybe from this calamity, we will start crawling out of that pit. And we can try to do all these, trying to go through different roads. Eventually, the roadmap is right before us. It's international law, it's justice and human rights and respect for the dignity of all people and for their rights and for their collective rights, for the right of self-determination. There will be no end for this, no end to bloodshed. There will be no end to the conflict without adhering to the principles that humanity has adopted throughout its long, scarred history of man-made catastrophes.
And, Michael, we have less than a minute, but if you could say something, sorry to interrupt you, about the status of the Israeli hostages who've been taken by Hamas. What do you know about them, and what do you expect will happen? What do you know about what might happen?
One of the terrible things about the hostage situation is that Hamas would not provide any information about their condition, and that is an abuse, a psychological abuse for the families. I heard all kinds of statements threatening to hurt them, to kill them. This is, I know very little, and unfortunately, my friends in Gaza, who are human rights, my colleagues in Gaza, I fear for them too, and I don't know how they are, if they are safe, if they are alive. This is, I just want to end with the following. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was a Holocaust survivor. She hid in the Warsaw ghetto and then in the Aryan side of Warsaw for several years with her mother and sister. And she wrote an autobiography where she wrote that probably the biggest challenge in the face of inhumanity, of being a victim of inhumanity, is to retain your own humanity. That's the biggest challenge. And in this area, there are so many victims. And the challenge is that those victims that went through living hell will retain their humanity.
Michael Savard, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli human rights lawyer. We're going to link to your new article for Haaretz titled, Israelis Must Maintain Their Humanity Even When Their Blood Boils, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Coming up, we speak with the Palestinian journalist Amjad Iraqi. Stay with us. Once Upon a City by Farah Suleiman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Palestinians and Israelis have grown accustomed to wars in the south in recent years, but the war that began in the early hours of Saturday, 7th October, is nothing like the others. Those are the opening lines of a new piece in the London Review of Books by our next guest, the Palestinian journalist Amjad Iraqi, who joins us now from London. The article is headlined, Get Out of There Now. Amjad is senior editor at 972 magazine and a policy member of Al-Shabaka. His latest piece for 972 is headlined, A Psychological Barrier Has Been Shattered in Israel-Palestine. Welcome to Democracy Now! Amjad, thank you so much for joining us. If you could explain why you think this invasion is different from the past, the 7th October one, and what psychological barrier has been broken?
Thank you all for having me. I think there's no doubt that in many respects what we've been witnessing over the past couple of days is what is being described as a game changer. And there are two ways to kind of think about this. One is this kind of material and military shift that has just occurred by the fact that Hamas broke out of the Gaza Strip, a besieged enclave, both in terms of targeting the military infrastructure, but also the massacres that happened in these Israeli southern towns that has really not only kind of broken this assumption of Gaza as this place that could maintain Palestinians and engage Hamas, but has really shaken this psychological barrier that exists in Israeli society and the Israeli establishment, that the occupation is somehow sustainable, and that if they just keep enforcing the institutions of apartheid, that if they keep pounding Hamas and the Gaza Strip as often as possible, that somehow that is actually going to bring them security, that is going to bring safety. And through that, they can then continue to claim that Israel is a democracy, that Israel is a safe place for the Jewish people. What we've witnessed with these atrocities that have happened is a complete shattering of that. It is broken to Israeli society that the Palestinians are not some distant problem, and that they cannot keep having the boot of their military apparatus upon them. Unfortunately, as Michael was referring to earlier, I'm not sure how much this will have a lot of soul-searching and reflection, as right now we are seeing this complete desire to inflict total revenge on the Gaza Strip, from the political establishment to the media all the way down. But I think that barrier that existed in the minds of Israeli society and the Israeli state, that this system could work, I think has really been broken by this assault.
You write, Amjad, in your Plus 972 piece, that these events will allow the most extremist elements within Netanyahu's far-right administration to carry out as much of their agenda as possible. Can you respond in particular to what the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, and the national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, convicted of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting hatred against Palestinians, what they want to happen now? And if you you think that will become the dominant actions of the Netanyahu government, the war government, as they're calling it right now, bringing in others into the government as well at this point?
So it's no secret that the Israeli government now is really primarily being led by a gang of far-right demagogues who have been very explicit for years, even before they arrived in office, about their ambitions for the Palestinians as a whole. And we're seeing that being put out in full force over the past few months since the government has been in place through the enabling and almost overt support of settler pogroms against West Bank towns and villages, and what is now eventually leading to the total expulsion of numerous Palestinian hamlets and people in order to make way for even more settler outposts and to even pave the way for more assertion of what they describe as Israeli sovereignty. We've been seeing this really being expedited in full force. And now for the far-right government, this massacre, as atrocious as it is for them a historic opportunity. It is for them reinforcing this idea that the only solution to what they regard as the Gaza problem is either the complete mass destruction of the Strip or to try to eliminate rather than merely contain Hamas's political and military apparatus. And if possible, and this is really one of the most horrific potentials, is the potential that this moment could be used to try to expel masses of Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip. The far-right ministers are very explicit about this ambition, and they really are trying to mobilize Israeli institutions in order to implement that process. And while we're still in the throes of the storm, but we're already seeing that first demand on their wish list being implemented in the way that our Palestinian colleagues from Gaza were just describing. And there's a massive mutual interest, not just on the part of the far-right politicians, but also the Israeli military, which has been really humiliated by this massive breach of the Gaza fences, by Hamas completely subverting its intelligence or its appearance of being able to know at all times what Hamas is doing. Because of this shattering, the Israeli military also arguably is in line with the political establishment of what to do with this. And time will tell where this leads, but we're already seeing this indulgence of revenge, not just from the Israeli institutions themselves, but also the international community, including the United States, which is basically telling Israel to go ahead and to actually justify that revenge and removing the political context without necessarily having to excuse the massacres, which they should not, but to nonetheless realize that there is no military solution to this issue. And the real problem in the end is this wider apartheid regime that is activating even when you don't have a war around Gaza, that is activating even on your so quote-unquote calm. And this is the bigger issue that needs to be addressed.
And Amjad, we just have a minute, but if you could say, you know, everybody says, as you said, this was unprecedented that Hamas broke through this barrier. People say, you know, they've been planning this attack for a long time. What statement have they made since this military assault on Gaza began? And what do you know of what they're doing with the hostages and whether they're willing to release them in exchange for Gaza getting some basic resources?
It's quite hard to say what the end game is entirely. In many ways, the assault also probably surprised them as much as it did the Israelis. And right now, I think it seems like they're trying to figure out what kind of bargaining chips they have in order to gain certain new kinds of agreements with the Israeli authorities, with the aid potentially of Arab states to try to mediate some kind of ceasefire that helps to meet certain Hamas demands. And they've been quite explicit about some of the things that they're seeking, which are long-standing issues that have existed even before this far-right government, including the issue of release of Palestinian prisoners, including provocations and aggressions around Jerusalem, especially around the holy sites, and also, of course, what's been happening in the West Bank under the Israeli occupation and settler violence. So these are kind of the big structural demands that are still at play, and it seems that Hamas is now trying to use tactically basically what they have right now to kind of turn the tables. But because we're still seeing the midst of this, it's very hard to know where this is leading.
Palestinian journalist Amjad Iraqi, we thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
reach the audience.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Everybody ready?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast or the Roots Program, depending on where you are located. I am Amanda Richard, and about the next 2 hours, I've got a mixture of folk music that I'm sure you will enjoy. What do we got coming up? We got a liquored up set, then we'll close down with a gospel set, and in between, we've got lots of music, old and new, that I think you will enjoy. Here comes something new from the bluegrass band, Nothing Fancy.
Friday night I'll be down at the bar again, getting back from long necks, hanging with my friends, telling jokes and stories we've all heard before. Hey, it's all right, and that's what bars are for. I'll be flirting with the waitress like I always do. She'll smile and say, honey, you ain't nothing but a darned old fool. And I'll tip my hat to everyone who walks through the door. Hey, it's all right, and that's what bars are for. It's a Friday night tradition, we're just carrying on. $8 in the jukebox, we'll all sing along. We'll cut a rug and shut our stuff down on that old dance floor. It's Friday night, it's alright, and that's what bars are for. I'll be back on the job again. 12 hours a day, just a bus in my rear end. I have no time to unwind, and that's for sure. Hey, it's alright, and that's what bars are for. It's a Friday night tradition, we're just carrying on. $8 in the jukebox, and we'll all sing along. We'll cut a rug, shut our stuff down on that old dance floor. It's Friday night, it's alright, and that's what bars are for. We'll be right back.